This is ACC CardiaCast, a series on the latest clinical education brought to you by the American College of Cardiology.
Welcome to a podcast from the ACC program, Cardiovascular Disease and Diabetes, Reducing the Burden. Today we're going to have a practical discussion about the risk benefits about starting new diabetes therapies in a patient with type 2 diabetes, with a focus on the off-target, or at least the non-glycemic effects of these drugs. My name is Dr. Michael Blaha. I'm a cardiologist at Johns Hopkins, and I'm joined by Melissa McGuire and Michael Nassif here. We'll have a discussion about patients that we treat in our clinics every day that have type 2 diabetes, and we're starting with novel therapies. So let's have a discussion really about SGLT2 inhibitors and GLP-1 receptor agonists and their many, many effects, right? When we think about SGLT2s, we're thinking about potential dehydration, issues with the kidneys and GFR, potential UTIs, peripheral vascular disease outcomes, and with GLP-1 receptor agonists, we're thinking about GI side effects and the weight loss effects, et cetera. So maybe, Mike, I'll start with you. Kind of, what are your thoughts when thinking about a patient with diabetes, let's say that has an A1C that's a little elevated, thinking about starting one of these new therapies, and you're going to try to decide what to start, maybe at what dose, et cetera, based on the specifics of that patient. Tell me about some of your thoughts. Let's say you're thinking about an SGLT2.
The majority of my clinic patients are heart failure patients, mm-hmm. and so when I look at a patient with cardiovascular disease, I think if I'm more worried about heart failure and potential volume overload, I favor the SGLT2s. We'll obviously have a lot more data in the next year or two, but the data we have to date from EMPA-REG shows convincingly that it decreased heart failure hospitalizations. The one caveat to that is the great majority of patients in that trial and all these trials don't have heart failure. So I think to date, we think that it's a preventative signal, that it prevents heart failure. Whether or not it will treat established heart failure, I think is yet to be determined. Right. But I think when I think about the risk benefit is for female patients and males who are uncircumcised, the risk of genital mycotic infections is certainly something to consider. If they've had a lot of difficulty in the past, I'm a cardiologist. Melissa could elaborate more, but I get nervous. People on very high doses of insulin who behave more like functionally a type 1, I do get a little bit nervous about the ketotic effects of the mm-hmm. SGLT2 inhibitors.
Right, because you can get a euglycemic ketoacidosis in some rare cases, right?
Yep, absolutely. And everyone actually gets a very low amount of ketosis. But so obviously people with type 1s are people that function more like type 1s.
So on that topic, a lot of your patients with a heart failure signal or at risk for heart failure also have kidney issues, mm-hmm. right? Their GFR might be reduced. Tell me just how you think about GFR issues and think about starting an SGLT2 inhibitor in your practice.
Yeah, so more and more as the evidence comes out, so the glycemic effects seem to be reduced in patients with lower GFRs. But when they looked at the EMPA-REG subset that even had GFRs as low as 30, they had just as much benefit as anyone else, both renal benefits and with cardiovascular outcomes benefits. So I don't shy too far away from starting it in GFRs 30 to 60. I think under 30, I don't think any clinical trials are currently enrolling that far, but it's mostly, to my understanding, because of the drugs less efficacious as the nephron is deteriorating its quality.
I think that's a great point. Really, in that reduced GFR range 30 to 60, you actually see tremendously improved kidney outcomes in those patients. So that's really something else to think about when you're prescribing. So Melissa, let's talk about GLP-1 receptor agonists. You know, obviously, we're thinking about injectable therapies versus oral therapies. That's one difference. But what are some of the other things you think about in considering a patient for one of those drugs in that class?
Well, looking at the GLP-1 receptor agonist, I sort of look at it treating multifacets of not only the type 2 diabetes spectrum, but also then looking at the cardiovascular benefits as well. And it's sort of a more bang for your buck is what we kind of talked to the patient about, that we're hitting multifacets of the disease. And then you've got the excellent secondary effects of weight loss.
Yes.
And appetite satiety effects that we see. And of course, all of our patients could benefit from that weight loss. And when educated properly and titrated the way it's supposed to be titrated, you can really lessen some of those GI effects that we all read in the package insert. I can tell you in our practice, having titrated patients a little slower, talking to them about not overeating, really doing a little bit of education can kind of pave the way and really lessen some of those side effects.
That's a good point. Yeah, so in your experience, are you seeing the weight loss in your practice that are seen in some of these trials where, of course, you could see 4 or 5 kilograms of weight loss?
Actually, we are, and sometimes even more. It really depends on the patient. And teaching the patient to pay attention to the signal that they're feeling, the overly full feeling, doing a little bit of behavior modification as well with it. But we are seeing some significant weight loss with that product.
That's great. So I think that's a good message, that you're able to, via teaching and talking to the patient, reduce some of the impact of some of the GI side effects.
Yes, and in the trials at least, that didn't happen. And so in the trials, the patients weren't really educated on what to expect. And so we sometimes think out in the real world that maybe some of the GI effects were heightened in the trial because patients weren't actually told to, hey, you know, stop eating, you're full, which seems like a simple thing but can make a huge difference in adherence.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And patients that aren't on anything injectable, have you found there have been hesitant to start a GLP-1 since it's currently only available through injections?
I actually haven't. When you talk to a patient about an injectable and you explain why and you explain that there is this secondary potential benefit of weight loss, it really doesn't seem to be as much pushback as traditional injectable therapy with insulin. Those of us that work with patients all day long educating on injectables, it's more the medication and not the injection itself. The injection comes in a pen with a very small, you can even use a 4-millimeter needle. So it's not the injection, but more what the medication is. And once the patient's educated, you get a lot of adherence and a lot of acceptance.
What do you see in the way of injection site reactions? Do you have a problem with that much?
Very rare. Very rare. I mean, it's known to happen. I think they saw some in the studies, but it's very rare. And it's usually a patient that's potentially got some sort of a allergic reaction to maybe one of the buffers in the medication itself. But injection technique, if taught correctly and the patient holds the injection for 4 to 10 seconds, not really an issue.
Great. So what about, Mike, what about peripheral vascular disease or peripheral arterial disease outcomes with SGLT2 inhibitors? Is that something that you're concerned about?
Yeah, I think, I think everyone was surprised, myself included, when Canvas read out and there was a statistically significant increase in amputations, particularly lower extremity amputations with canagliflozin. Interestingly, it hasn't been seen with empagliflozin to date, but we're going to get, I think, nearly 20,000 patients in randomized trials reading out in the next couple of years. So we'll see. Analysis I've seen, the number one risk factor, the hazard ratio was over 20 to have an amputation on canagliflozin was previous amputation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think the general rule right now is anyone with peripheral vascular disease or at risk of an amputation, I would hesitate on canagliflozin in particular.
Right. The highest of the risk.
Yeah.
Extremity disease patients, it sounds like. Was there anything else that I haven't mentioned yet that you think about on a daily basis when thinking about initiating one of these drugs or even dosing issues? Any other issues you think about?
I think the main thing is just to target the patient to what maybe their highest risk is. Like you mentioned earlier, if it's someone that we're really worried about some heart failure issues, probably starting with the SGLT2s to begin with. If it's more of a coronary artery disease, MI issue, also a little bit more hyperglycemic perhaps, then we'll go with the GLP-1 receptor agonist. But really not necessarily looking at the route of administration to make my decision, because there are easy ways to teach both, and both just require a little bit of education on the front side to improve adherence and an outcome on the back side. So
I got a question. So this comes up with my patients sometimes. I'm talking to them about heart failure and SGLT2s. What, in terms of the mechanism, or if they ask you kind of how does this work, what do you tell them?
Lucky enough to see a panel of the world's experts talk about this, and the conclusion I got out of it is nobody has any idea.
I don't know.
I think what's agreed upon is it almost certainly has nothing to do with glycemic control.
Good point, yeah.
Obviously, they are diuretics, but in the grand scheme, they're a pretty weak diuretic. Mm-hmm. They do appear to have some effect on renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system, just in the sense it's the only diuretic I know of that will lower blood pressure and not increase heart rate. So there seems to be some neurohormonal modulation, but I think it was a surprise to everyone that the SGLT2s had such a robust heart failure benefit. And because of that, we have EMPEROR and EMPEROR Preserved.
Right. The follow-up studies they'll be looking for.
And all have very dedicated biomarker, echo, and imaging sub-studies, which I think are going to shed a lot of light on the mechanism.
I hope you all found this discussion of kind of the risk-benefit analysis of starting a new diabetes therapy helpful. And thank you for joining us on this ACC program, Cardiovascular Disease and Diabetes, Reducing the Burden.
This has been the ACC CardiaCast, your latest education from the American College of Cardiology. Go to acc.org to find this and other additional resources related to today's show.